Last year, at around this time, I went out to Silicon Valley to report on the changing economy there. It's actually the region of the country with the greatest economic mobility. There are a lot of fast-growing companies, chances to move up the ladder, but also growing inequality and incredibly high rents, the byproducts of a boom. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We've got a lot in the show this week about those kinds of byproducts, the consequences of rapid economic change. You'll hear from a young woman about being a contract worker in the tech industry and the uncertainty that comes with it. And in Silicon Valley and beyond, we are becoming a nation of renters. Rents are eating up much more of family incomes than they used to. It might be a hangover from the housing crisis. It might be the new normal. We've got the author of a fascinating new report, plus a book so good I can't stop thinking about it. As always, come share your thoughts with us at Marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting the show with our own marketplacey way of looking at the news. We all know that the world of finance can be filled with jargon, and frankly, a lot of it is useless. But there are two terms we like to use here, long and short. Long as in betting on something, like a stock, short as in betting against it. We do it with news stories and current events. And this week, we have Marketplace's foreign editor, John Buckley, and the host of our video explainer series, The Marketplace Whiteboard, Patty Hirsch. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, I'd like to give you the opportunity to go first. What are you long?
I'm long on the migrant or refugee crisis in the European Union. There was a tentative deal struck with Turkey last week. Will it hold? Is it morally acceptable? I don't know. This one could run and run.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
when you say you're long on that, does that mean what? It goes forever? I mean, how do you imagine Europe looking in several months, years, whatever?
I wouldn't predict how Europe's going to look in 7 weeks, but at the moment. But what I would say is this, that this appears to be to have all the signs of an apparent agreement that actually has relatively little prospects of holding in the longer term.
Yeah, I'm with John here. I mean, if you look at what's been happening, even with I think the British committed the Royal Navy to the seas in the Mediterranean, and everybody thought, well, this means that they're going to actually stop migrants from leaving Turkey, actually stop them in the water, which is what the Australians did several years ago with migrants who were thinking about coming to their shores. But in actual fact, the Royal Navy says that it's only there just to monitor the refugees. It's not actually going to stop anybody. So there seems to be a lot of talk, not a lot of action. I'd be long on the migrant crisis as well.
Well, what are you long other than the migrant crisis, Patty?
Long other than the migrant crisis? Well, I'm actually long Maria Sharapova, actually.
Really?
A lot of people are really down on Maria. I think actually that, she's had a little bit of a problem right now. Obviously, she has admitted to taking these banned drugs, and a lot of her sponsors have pulled out. But I think that, regardless of a ban on her playing tennis, I think that within 5 years, you'll see her back again.
Because she's, let's face it, a bankable asset for companies. Not only is she, a top athlete, but she has a lot of things that companies like. She is an attractive white lady. And, to be crass, advertisers like that.
Yeah, I'm afraid that we may not like the sound of that. And I think that a lot of people in the African-American community who compare her to Serena Williams, who has beaten her in the last 18 mm-hmm. matches that she has played and said, it's really not fair. I agree, it's not fair at all. But unfortunately, I think that's the way the world works.
John, what are you short?
Well, I think I'm short on Brexit, which is a sort of interminable, long drum roll. Britain is the fifth largest economy in the world, the second largest in the EU, and it represents a number of things in the EU. It represents, free trade. It represents a neoliberal economic policy in a way. UK would be a big loss for Europe. Would Europe be a big loss for the UK? I don't know.
John and I agree on a great many things, that Punjana is the best type of British tea that you can buy, that Walker's is the best shortbread, and of course we agree on the Cadbury's debacle. However,
the big things.
I cannot, however, concur on being short on Brexit. I am long Brexit because I believe that even if the UK opts to stay in the European Union on June the 23rd after this referendum, I think that all of these other countries that have lined up behind it to say, well, maybe we think maybe we should leave. This is a story that's going to run and run and run. Europe is in trouble. A lot of countries are really worried about being part of the European Union. And I don't think that a Brexit itself, or the absence of a Brexit, will actually negate the desire of other countries to break loose from the bureaucratic nightmare that is the European Union.
All right, let's go to your short, Paddy.
I'm short Volkswagen. So this
My
week,
goodness, this is such a Eurocentric edition.
Well, it is,
I mean,
but it was
both
interesting.
Of you, but
well,
okay.
It isn't, because remember, you know, whether or not Volkswagen rises or falls in many ways is going to depend on what the ruling that comes in the US about these emission standards and what VW is going to have to do to adjust. And so we had a couple of things that happened this week, which the first was that VW officials in Germany stood up in front of their workers and said, if we get hammered by a big fine from the US, a lot of you guys are going to lose your jobs. So brace yourself for that. And the second was a little bit of sort of insider stuff about the way the legal shenanigans that went on at VW, where apparently they knew quite a long way ahead of the actual official announcement about this malarkey that was going on with these I can't even talk about it that much because Mike, I own one of these cars, but with these emissions, they knew about it a long time in advance, but they didn't say anything about it because they wanted to have a better negotiating position when it came to actually, you know, confessing their sins. So I am pretty sure VW at this point.
One thing customers do not like is being lied to.
I could speak very personally to this. I'm driving that thing around all day long thinking, I'm being lied to every time I press down on the accelerator.
I'd think particularly as well when part of VW's sales pitch in a way has been this German dependability, reliability and trustworthiness.
Mm. Yeah. Vorsprung durch lies.
I want to bring up one thing because I know you have differing positions on this. John, you are long Donald Trump, and Patty, you could not be more short. Go for it.
Couldn't be any shorter.
I'm long because I think that, okay, Donald Trump in this incarnation is a populist politician. If he gets the White House, of course, he's going to be long for a period. If he doesn't get the White House, there are those who think he's going to sort of simply fade away. But I think he is now a national voice, and I think that he is also a businessman. You saw this display of Trump wine, Trump steak, Trump casinos, Trump hotels, whatever, over the past few weeks. So I think that because of some of the stances that he's taken politically, it's going to have reverberations in his business operations. There are those
in a positive way?
Well, positive or negative. I think some will say, Donald Trump, he's our kind of guy. I'm going to support him whenever I can. And I think there are those who are going to say that they are essentially boycotting Trump, or that he's not quite as marketable a commodity anymore as a, I don't know, as a sort of entertainer in a way. So it could go either way for Donald Trump, but I think it's definitely a long one.
Yeah, I'm short because I think he's gonna get the nomination. I think there's no doubt about that. He's gonna come up against Hillary in the elections. I've got no doubt about that either. And she is going to hammer a stake into his heart.
Not a Trump stake.
It won't fit. Yeah, she's gonna hammer the vampire stake into his heart, and that is gonna be the end of him politically. Slightly nuanced though, because I think that there will be a political legacy for Donald Trump, though. I think that in the same way that, you know, Barry Goldwater kind of changed the face of the Republican Party, I think that Trump is going to do the same thing. This populism that he's shown up, not just in the Republican Party, but in the nation at large, is going to resonate through our politics for the next 20 years at least.
I'd like to ask Paddy on this. There is a theory that both Donald Trump supporters and supporters of Bernie Sanders are people who feel that the current order is shortchanging them in some way, economically, that they're fed up with Washington because economically they are losing out. What do you think of that?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that what Donald Trump, the genius of Donald Trump, is that he has pulled the veil off the reality of the situation of American workers, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, there's a huge chunk of the workforce or the population, because a lot of them aren't working, that have been left behind by the advances in the economy. You know, all of these trade agreements that we've had, all of the move to technology, all of the outsourcing that we've seen, that has left large numbers of people, swathes of the American population behind. They're either unemployed or underemployed, and they are being voluble about it now. Somebody's given them a voice.
I think if you take away the questions of racial and ethnic composition, I think if you take away the conversation about religion, if you move all of that to the side, that's a considerable lift. The single strongest part of Trump's appeal is just citing median income stagnation over and over again. And that's something I think politicians on both sides have not come up with a good answer for.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree too.
Good Lord. We're all in agreement.
We're in agreement. Patty Hirsch, John Buckley, thank you both very much.
Our pleasure, Lizzie. Thank you.
Thank you.
No matter who you are, you probably had a job that changed you somewhere along the line. Or maybe you learned a financial lesson that stuck with you. On this show, we ask writers, artists, and musicians to open up and tell us how money and work have changed their lives. Here's Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hello, everybody. I'm M. Ward, and I'm a musician. I live in Portland, Oregon.
When did you realize music could be an actual paying career?
Probably my first transatlantic flight. My first record was released on a small label out of Belgium, and so I got this free flight to Brussels, which I, you know, was very excited about. I learned later on there was going to be about four layovers, but you know, I got to Brussels for free on someone else's budget, and that was just eye-opening to me that you can, just by making music, that it can take you to some interesting places. So I remember walking around the Grand Place in Brussels thinking, yeah, this is something I can maintain.
Slow brain, winner heart, first name Rollo.
In the next life, what would your career be?
Something where you get to be outdoors. I've always had this idea, like an outback ranger would be a pretty great job, or a deep sea explorer, Jacques Cousteau kind of stuff. Just you and the elements.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
It's the mental imprisonment of your mind, especially when you're traveling and when you're on tour. You don't get a chance to nurture anything except for music and your stage show and your ego, and that can put a limit on what you're taking in. So people that have normal, everyday 8-to-5 jobs have their own problems, but after their work, they get to do any array of things to make sure that their mind is being exercised, and that always is seemed like a better connection to the rest of how the planet lives.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
The first thing that comes to mind is my last bad purchase, which was NFL Game Pass. You know, I like the Seattle Seahawks, so I like to stay in touch. But you get on their website, and it only works half the time. They overcharge you, and they send you annoying emails for the rest of your life. So that's a purchase I regret. The whole trend of, you know, even going to buy a bottle of water at Rexall, all of a sudden you're on their email list or you're on their Facebook page, and I hope that's a trend that stays in the decade that we're in right now.
What is your most prized possession?
To be perfectly honest, I don't have any. There's it used to be guitars, and then when you travel, they break. And so I learned very quickly, don't take expensive guitars while you're traveling. But even more importantly, don't even own expensive guitars, because you don't even need them. So a lot of collectors would argue with me, as well they should. You know, half the time a $50 guitar you find at a pawn shop fits the bill of what you're going for in the studio faster than the $3,000 guitar that you could buy at Guitar Center. That's just my opinion. What was the first album you ever bought? First album I ever bought was a cassette by the Smiths. It was called The Queen Is Dead. So, you know, everyone has that record by now, I guess. But it was really exciting when I first got that.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started in music?
Don't listen to anyone's advice. Nobody knows what they're saying about music, about somebody else's music. People can only speak intelligently about, put it this way, the less you listen to other people, the more you sound like yourself.
You're kind of small and you're such a ball. I'm glad you're mine. You're so good to me.
M. Ward's latest album, More Rain, is out now.
You hold my hand when you understand that I get in a bad mood. You're so good to me. And I love it, love it.
This week's conversation with listeners grew out of something we've seen again and again in our polling data and election coverage. Despite improvements in the economy, Americans are still incredibly anxious about it. So we wanted to know, when it comes to your economy, what's at the top of your worry list? Luann Stinson is 57 and lives in Omaha, Nebraska. She's the breadwinner in her marriage, and a steady job is at the top of her list.
Staying employed, money.
And tell me why.
My husband and I relocated here after we both lost our jobs in Las Vegas. And I stayed in Las Vegas trying to sell the house. Ended up being a short sale. Mm. So he got a job. He had it for 4 years. And then he got sick. And he has had continual health challenges since 2012 when he was diagnosed with cancer. He's often sick from chemo. So we just decided that he would stop looking for work once I got the job that I have now.
Are you worried at all about retirement?
Oh, man. I can't even think about retirement. It just doesn't seem like anything that's attainable. That one of us will always have to be trying to find some kind of income. And I don't know what that's going to be, right, 20 years from now for me. But I hope there's something.
What do you think you've learned through all of this?
And that's interesting. I always try to look at things that happen as something that needed to happen so that I could learn. This one taught me again that obviously resilience is critical to getting by. If you can't come back and think more positively that something good will happen and that you can recover from whatever did happen, then you can't get up the next day. But I think that it's taken a while. I mean, we're almost 6 years down the road from when all that stuff happened in Las Vegas. And, you know, I can get up every morning now and be happy and go to work and be grateful. And, you know, my husband is still alive and my job is still there for me and I enjoy what I do. And I think that learning from everything that happens in my life is important. Every relationship I have, you know, why did that person come into my life? I like to think that I learned from those things. And, you know, why did I have to go through the last few years? I'm not exactly sure the lesson I was intended to learn, but I know that I have my family to support me. I know that I can recover. I know that I can go on, no matter what hits me.
Luann Stinson, thank you so much for your candor and your time.
Thank you.
Then there are people like Michelle Rundy, She's 24, lives in Silicon Valley, and the very nature of the work that's available to her there, contract work, is what has her worried.
I currently am a contractor at a major tech company, and while it's been great, I don't get full benefits, and I'm struggling a little bit to find full-time employment. All the available opportunities to me seem to just be more and more contracts, and I feel like I'm a little insecure with how long I'm going to have my job.
What would having a full-time job with benefits mean for you?
I would feel a little more comfortable pushing myself career-wise. When you're a contractor, and I'm renewed on a three-month basis, I might add, you don't feel like you want to be as aggressive with your ideas. You don't want to put yourself out there as much because there's always that risk where if they don't like what you say or if you step on the wrong toes, you're very easy to let go. You don't have the built-in protection of being a full-time employee, not to mention healthcare benefits, stock options, all those things that are not available to me.
If you could say something to them, what would you say?
I would ask, why is what I'm doing not as valuable to you as something that a full-time employee is doing? Why does my work mean that I can be let go in a year and someone one building over, they get to stay on? Why is what I'm doing less important?
So when you say kind of look forward in your own life the next year, year and a half, do you have a sense of what that's going to look like?
I really don't, which is uncomfortable for me because I was the person who wanted to graduate college, have a job secure, build my career, work years up, and, you know, be high-level manager by the time I was 35. High aspirations. But with a contract, with this contract-to-contract situation, I really feel insecure about where I could be in 5 years. I just hope I'm employed, frankly, and making a livable wage, especially here in the Valley. It is not cheap just to even make rent.
Michelle Rundy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Next week, we'll have data on economic anxiety from our polling work with Edison Research. So we want to keep this conversation going. What's at the top of your economic worry list? Your personal finances? Something in the bigger economy? Let us know by going to marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air.
I just purchased what they call a manufactured home. It would have cost me more to rent for the 15 years if I lived that long than it would have to buy.
I rent. I don't think I'll have multiple homes, but one would be nice.
Pay the rent!
As a karate expert, I will not talk about anyone up here because our children can't afford to live anywhere. Nowhere. There's nowhere to go. Once again, why? You said it, the rent is too damn high.
How we gonna pay? How we gonna pay? How we gonna pay last year's rent?
Yeah, that's the musical Rent. And a few voices, including activist Jimmy McMillan, who popularized the phrase,
the rent is too damn high.
And, well, according to a new study, it is. New York University's Furman Center and Capital One analyzed the landscape of affordable rental housing in the U.S. from 2006 to 2014. They found that the number of renters in 11 metropolitan areas increased by 22 million people, and the number of affordable rental units fell. While this hits low-income people the hardest, it also affects an increasing number of people higher on the income ladder, and not just in cities, but in suburbs, too. Ingrid Gould-Ellen is the co-author of the study and the faculty director of the Furman Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's driving this?
You know, I mean, it's a number of factors that are driving it. I think some part of it is the lingering effects of the foreclosure crisis. People lost their homes. They haven't been able to return to home ownership. In some cases, it's economic reasons. We've had a somewhat limp recovery, especially for low and moderate income households. So you're seeing sort of fewer people have been able to garner the savings that they need for down payments. Down payment requirements have increased. We've seen, and of course, the cost as rents rise, that makes it, people are then renting and spending more of their savings on rent and therefore are less able to save. That kind of, it's a vicious circle. And also there are demographic factors. So people are, are marrying at later ages. They're having children at later ages. And often it means they are purchasing homes at later ages.
One of the things that stuck out to me was that the typical renter could afford fewer than 40% of the units on the market, in these large metro areas that you looked at. Does that mean that the average person is being priced out of a rental unit?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's striking is that, I do not want to downplay the severe affordability pressures that low-income renters face. So in all of the metropolitan areas we studied, more than 60% of low-income renters are paying more than half of their income on rent. But one of the things that we're seeing that's been a real shift is that those affordability pressures are climbing up the income spectrum. And now we're seeing in many areas in Miami, the typical renter could only have afforded 15% of the rental units that were on the market in 2014. And in Los Angeles, it was 21%. In New York City, in the New York City metropolitan area, it was 22%.
So if you're the mayor of a city and you listen to this interview or read this study, what should the response be?
That's a good question. I mean, I think one of the things that this suggests is that there is a rising demand for rental housing up there. The market hasn't quite caught up. One of the reasons might be because it's very difficult to build rental housing. And so I think this does suggest we should be taking a look at our zoning laws, at our land use regulations, and trying to figure out ways to make rental housing easier to build. Another thing that it might suggest is that we might want to figure out other vehicles to help households save, perhaps, for retirement, or perhaps in order to save for a down payment to buy a home in the future.
When I was starting out, I remember making a budget with my parents, and the wisdom then was, okay, you should spend about 25% of your income on rent. And the numbers in this study show that people certainly aren't doing that. What's the right amount, do you think?
Well, the standard, there's no single number, right? That's the right amount. The standard that housing researchers and policymakers use is 30% of your income. Frankly, at this point, in 8 of the 11 metropolitan areas we studied, most renters paid more than 30% of their income on rent. And the standard that we seem to be using more and more now is actually 50% of your income on rent. And,
wow.
And so, in all of the metropolitan areas we studied, more than 60% of low-income renters paid more than half of their income on rent. And in 7 of the metropolitan areas, more than 75% of low-income renters paid more than half of their income on rent.
I have to ask you, because I have you on the air, do you own or rent?
I rent. I'm in New York.
Yeah, me too, and I rent. Ingrid Gould Ellen, Faculty Director of NYU's Furman Center. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
What do you got for me this week?
All right. I thought since, springtime is in the air, we could talk about one of
nice weather.
Nice weather. We could maybe talk about one of my favorite things to do when I was growing up.
There's so many directions we could go with this, but go ahead.
Well, I really liked going to amusement parks, Lizzie. Did you?
Yeah.
Space Mountain?
Space Mountain was a
big... You down with Space Mountain?
Yes. I like the scary ones.
Much like everything else, tech is, of course, changing our experiences at amusement parks. This, by some pretty friendly to parks estimates, some industry estimates, is an industry worth $200 billion annually.
Okay.
When you think about technology as a tool, technology is already built into the DNA of amusement parks, right? It's part of the rides that we experience, from the creepy Disney animatronics.
Pirates of the Caribbean,
state-of-the-art roller coasters. This stuff is sort of in the ether, and it's a tool to be used for our amusement.
Well, give me some examples of that.
Let's talk about the thrills.
Okay.
Abu Dhabi has Ferrari World.
Whoa.
And Ferrari World has a roller coaster that zips riders from 0 to 150 miles an hour in less than 5 seconds.
Seriously?
Which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
I have not been to this one, but it gives you the kind of G-forces that are usually reserved for fighter pilots.
I would do this
right?
in a heartbeat. Okay, yeah. Next. Yes,
yeah.
More.
Are you excited? Okay. Yeah. It uses compressed nitrogen gas. It has 21,000 horsepower, and it has a 25-ton winch that thrusts riders forward.
Wow.
Yeah. Another way that modern theme parks are changing is information.
Like what? Like sort of app-based things?
Yeah. So certain amusement parks have their own custom apps that help you get around from one attraction to another. My Disney Experience is one example. But also there are more general apps like Ride Hopper Park Wait Times. This app promises to help you know which lines are longest at a given park and which rides to go to, try to jump on. A lot of this stuff requires other users to be really useful.
Yeah.
So it
feels like some of the traffic sharing software almost that people use to navigate cities.
Exactly. This is very similar to the traffic information that you might get from Google Maps, for instance.
Yeah.
And this is starting to be used in amusement parks, which is really interesting.
All right. We're talking about this because it is sort of spring break season. If you're out there right now, you're taking your kids somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening right now?
Virtual reality, Lizzie.
Really?
Hilariously. Yes. Is something that's happening right now. Samsung and Six Flags are launching something strange. They're adding virtual reality headsets to rides at spots around the country.
Isn't the point of going to the amusement park to go to the amusement park?
You would have thought.
Yeah.
You would have thought. This is actually what makes this a little bit different. You're still on the ride. You're outdoors with all the loops and the wind in your hair, the nausea, the excitement, all that stuff. But when you're about to get on the roller coaster, you'll be handed a Galaxy 7 smartphone and a Gear VR headset.
Is this just a marketing play?
Well, let's see. I think you might call it a bit of a marketing ploy, a bit of a way to get people introduced to the latest Samsung phone and the latest VR headset, right? Theme park attendees are captive audiences. You pay to get in, and then you're sort of at the mercy of the theme park in some ways. And this is a good way for Samsung really to get into people's minds. But every time you get on a ride, you could have a different experience with a VR headset. So maybe you're getting, you know, rolled around and thrown around and you're in the Wild West. And then the next time you get on, you're shooting missiles at alien spaceships.
Oh.
So there are some applications here. We've seen how some amusement parks have struggled with making money in the past. And this could be a way for parks to kind of save some dough and make people want to come back without shelling out the money to build actual new rides.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. But it also seems like there could be almost some competition here, because if you have the virtual reality experience, do you need to go to the theme park?
Lizzie, that's a really good question. It may be that this particular idea falls flat, but the idea of combining immersive video experiences and roller coasters has been around forever, right? I mean, from special 3D attractions at parks to—
I mean, Space Mountain when I was 8, you were kind of zooming through the thing.
Exactly. Yeah. VR experiences themselves often have this kind of roller coaster vibe to them. You're moving through an environment. Maybe parks themselves will have to revamp to take advantage of VR. You could have virtual reality scavengers. Scavenger hunts or like escape rooms, zombie apocalypse missions. So VR could be part of this. It's just a matter of the parks themselves figuring out how to use virtual reality and use some of this new technology.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
The vehicle doors will close automatically. Please remain seated during your tour, keeping your hands and arms inside the vehicle, and kindly refrain from smoking.
There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace shows so much.
numbers are a huge part of the economic and financial world. And every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog finds the stories behind those numbers and posts them on our site, marketplace.org. Producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe have a recap of this week, By the Numbers. Tobin.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
285.
That's how many yards Donald Trump has said he can hit a golf ball. Wait, why do we care?
Because it's a tidbit that Donald likes to mention whenever rumors swirl about his allegedly small hands.
Or when an app decides to throw a subtle dig at him through a system upgrade.
Okay, so this week, Yelp released a new version of their app. The description read, "Our latest release easily trumps our old version. It's usable no matter how small your hands are."
Two.
That's how many games of Go have been won by Google's AI program in its tournament against world champion human player Lee Sedol.
The two are currently playing a five-game tournament to see if AlphaGo can take down the world's best player.
We've seen tournaments like this before with chess, but Go is considered a harder game. And so far, the computer is definitely winning.
250,000.
That's about how many dollars it costs for a ticket to space.
This week, Jeff Bezos announced that Blue Origin, his space tourism company, will be able to take up paying astronauts by 2018.
The trip comes complete with brief moments of weightlessness and a killer view of the Earth.
Well, that's it. I'm out of here, Tony.
Wait, Tobe, where are you going?
Space, my friend. Space.
Tobin is actually leaving the Marketplace family, though not for outer space. From all of us, thank you, Tobin. We will miss your smarts and humor very much. In formal economics, the term productivity has an equation: output per unit of input. For example, how many donuts a baker can produce per hour. But out in the world, the word productivity has all kinds of extra meaning. It's about efficiency or being the very best version of your workday self. Sometimes even hearing the word productivity makes me feel guilty, like I'm not trying hard enough. New York Times journalist Charles Duhigg has written a new book called Smarter, Faster, Better that explores how work, time, productivity, and life collide. I had so much fun talking to him that we're going to play pretty much the whole thing. We are going to start on an airplane. In 2010, a flight from Singapore to Sydney.
Yes, Singapore to Sydney.
Singapore to Sydney, and essentially everything goes wrong. Multiple
terribly
engine
wrong.
Problems, et cetera. This is Qantas Flight 32. And the captain on this flight, Richard de Crepigny, does a bunch of things right. And I want you to tell me what they are.
It's exactly right. It's a fascinating story because this is one of the worst mid-air mechanical failures ever. One of the blades on the turbine in the jet engine shears off and shoots through the wing. And it actually creates a hole as big as a man's body.
Mm.
And as it explodes, it creates a shrapnel that cuts through like electrical lines and fuel lines. Basically, almost every single major system in the plane all of a sudden stops working.
I covered aviation before I came to Marketplace, and one of the things I noticed here is that he's calling out commands, and some of the other officers on the plane say no. And that's remarkable in aviation, and we're going to get into why this is important in business and work. But what happened?
Well, so what's really interesting about this particular flight is – and you know this as a former aviation reporter – is that this particular crew had been really well trained in what's known as situational awareness, right? And we find that actually very productive people, they all have this tendency, which is that they tell themselves stories about what's going on in their lives all the time. They build these mental models. And Richard de Crepigny, before they had actually gotten on the plane, he was taking his crew and he was saying, look – if this goes wrong, what are you going to do first? Like, where do your eyes go? Where do your hands go? He was taking them through scenarios and saying, let's start telling ourselves a story about what's going to happen if there's an accident. But the thing is about this accident is that it's so overwhelming. It's so devastating that everybody doesn't know what to do at first. They become almost overwhelmed by this flow of emergency warnings and commands from the computer that tells them fix this or respond to that problem. And it becomes a situation where even though they're very well prepared for this, they're so overwhelmed that they almost can't function. And that's when Richard de Crepigny makes this very critical shift in his thinking.
Which is?
So what he does is he actually takes his hands off the control panel and he closes his eyes. Now, keep in mind, this is a plane that's midair. Basically, everything is failing. It's got a huge hole in the wing. People can see the hole in the wing out the windows.
And more than 400 people are on board.
More than 400 people are on board. And they're basically sort of cruising through and they almost can't control the plane. And what Richard de Crespigny does is he takes his hands off the controls. He closes his eyes and he says to himself, I need to start telling myself a different story about this plane. I can't think of it as an Airbus A380 anymore. Instead, what I need to do is I need to think of it as a Cessna. Now, a Cessna, for anyone who's flown, as you know, it's almost like a toy plane, right? It's what hobbyists use or people learn to fly on. It's this small, incredibly simple airplane. An Airbus, the A380, is this huge, complex piece of machinery. But Richard de Crespigny says, I need to imagine this plane as a Cessna because in a Cessna, all that you have to focus on is essentially a couple of things. Your wheels, your trim, your rudder. And what he needed to do is he needed to eliminate distractions and focus what was on the important things. But when you're in the middle of an emergency, it's so easy to get overwhelmed by all that information. So he starts telling himself a new story about a Cessna. And as a result, he's able to land this plane safely because he knows what to focus on and what to ignore.
My life, your life, not as complicated as someone with several hundred people depending on them. Why is this anecdote important in terms of understanding how to be, I don't know, better at your sales job?
Well, it's because even though we think of our lives as not being that complex, it maybe isn't quite as dangerous, but our lives are complex, right? I mean, think about what all the things that you're exposed to in an average day. You're getting all these emails all the time, right? And your phone is vibrating in your pocket. And then you go into a meeting and you're trying to think about what you want to say next when suddenly your boss asks you an unexpected question and you have to respond to them. And at the same time, there's some emergency email coming over. Right? Our lives are incredibly complex and they are only getting more complex as technology and the economy drives us to be faster and to try and deal with more information. And so the question then becomes, how do the most productive companies and people, how do they deal with all this information overload?
So you've sketched out a couple of different principles that allow companies and people to do that. What are they?
Well, the number one thing is that the best people act like de Crespigny. They think to themselves, what story should I be telling myself about my day, about myself? How do I build a mental model that allows me to pay attention to the things that matter and ignore the distractions that I don't have to focus on right now? Now, it turns out that our brain is actually pretty bad on its own at figuring out how to make sense of a huge amount of information coming in, unless we have some structure to put it in, unless we have a story that we're telling ourselves where we're anticipating what are the things that we expect to have happen. And we're primed to respond to those. And what's unexpected, which means we might be able to ignore those things or at least put them aside and say, I don't have to react right away. Instead, I'm going to give myself a moment to process it and think about what's going on. So when your boss asks you that question unexpectedly in the middle of the meeting and you've got five things on your brain, instead of splurting out some answer that might be the wrong thing to say, you can say, look, the story in my head, it doesn't anticipate this question. So I'm going to give myself a couple of beats before I answer, because I really need to think about what I'm going to say.
That comes up under a chapter called Focus. And I'm going to flip back to one called Teams, which also struck me as very important in just about anybody's workaday life. The ingredients that make a successful team, they were not what I thought they would be before I read this book. The thing that comes up over and over again is psychological safety. What is that and how is that important in, you know, a meeting in your office?
I love this chapter. And in fact, I love the fact that its roots are in a study that Google did that took 4 years and millions of dollars to try and figure out how to build the perfect team. And when they went into this, what they said is exactly what you just said, that teams are really important now. And building the perfect team is probably a matter of like taking the best people and putting them together, right? That like maybe you need introverts and extroverts. Turns out that's totally wrong. The who is on a team matters much, much less than how the team interacts. And at the core of this is exactly what you said, this idea called psychological safety. Teams become most effective when people feel like they are safe to say things among each other without recriminations. And the way that you create psychological safety, according to all these studies, is two things. First of all, you need to have equality in conversational turn-taking, or basically everyone on the team needs to feel like they can pipe up and say what they want to say. But that on itself isn't enough. You also have to have what's called high average social sensitivity, which means that if I see that you're crossing your arms and you're kind of upset, that I say to you, Lizzie, what's going on? Like, why aren't you talking up? Or if you look really excited, that I pick up on that and I say, hey, Lizzie, it looks like you're really enthusiastic about this idea, that I'm showing you that I'm actually listening to you. If you have a team, as long as people feel like they can say whatever they want to and that other people are actually showing that they're listening, then it doesn't matter if you like each other or you play Frisbee together or if you have nothing in common. That team is much more likely to be successful because that psychological safety makes me feel like I can bring my whole self to work.
Yet that does seem like it would be sort of contradictory to the faster part of of this title, because if everybody gets to talk in the meeting, that's going to be a long meeting.
Well, that's the thing that we find about productivity, particularly the science of productivity, is that much of what actually makes us productive, on the face of it, doesn't seem efficient. Right? You're exactly right. It would be much easier to walk into a meeting and say, Jim's the expert. Let's all do what Jim says. Similarly, it'd be much faster to have a captain who says, look, I'm not gonna think about all these different scenarios. I'm just going to deal with problems as they arise. But what we know is that particularly in today's economy and with this technology that's emerging, oftentimes being busy and being productive are actually at odds with each other. Doing what seems efficient isn't the same thing as making decisions and choices that allow us to be more productive.
I look at this book, your previous book, The Power of Habit. I feel like there are a lot of books out there that are sort of about this collision of psychology, work, economics. Why do you think we're so interested as a society in this stuff right now?
I think we're living through an economic and cultural revolution that most economists at this point agree is as profound as the agrarian revolution and the industrial revolution. And when that happens, there is anxiety, right?
Although because not all of us equally.
Not all of us equally. And the fact that things are changing, particularly in ways that we don't totally understand, that causes anxiousness. And so the question then becomes, so how can I take advantage of what we know to prepare myself? And we're lucky in that at the same time that this revolution is occurring, we're also living through a golden age of understanding neurology, right? We're understanding things about the brain. We're understanding things about organizational psychology that we never knew before. Behavioral economics has opened up this whole new field. And so we actually have these new tools to understand why people behave the ways that they do, how they can behave better. And so we're looking as a society, as a humanity, for answers. Why is it that although I now have email and all these devices and I can work from anywhere, why do I feel so busy and overwhelmed all the time? And the answer is because we oftentimes mistake busyness for productivity, but we're beginning to learn how to moderate the information and the inputs and how to take control of our brains in a way that let us become the people that we want to be.
Well, what is true productivity?
I think productivity differs from person to person and place to place, right? So for you, productivity in the morning might be getting through all of your emails. But on the weekend, it might be, you know, being able to straighten the house and have a nice relaxing brunch. For someone with kids, it might mean getting home in time to have dinner. For someone who's not married yet, it might mean being able to like look at three or four potential spouses in a week, right? It differs from person to person and time and place to place. But what's important is that what we know is that when people become more proactive instead of reactive, when they understand how their brain functions better and can take control of how they're thinking and what they're doing, then however they define productivity, it's within closer reach.
What are the biggest mistakes that companies and people make when trying to be more productive?
I think the biggest mistakes that people make is that they become purely reactive, right? They start mistaking this busyness for productivity. They say that if you get to inbox zero, then you must be really productive. But we all know people who respond to emails right away and they end up wasting a huge amount of time because half those emails don't need responses, or they train their colleagues to send them questions that they could have answered on their own. It's really about stopping and deciding, what are my actual goals? What do I want? How do I arrange those goals in my life? How do I manage my focus? How do I self-motivate in a way that I can get what I think I most need and is most useful out of each day, rather than simply reacting to all these demands and inputs around me?
How have you changed your own life. Come on, you wrote the, it says smarter, better, faster. Are you?
I think I am. I think so. So this book actually began because I had written The Power of Habit, and it had just come out, and I was working on a series at the New York Times about Apple. I was more professionally successful than I had ever been before, and I was miserable. I felt like I was just running like a chicken with its head cut off all the time. And I felt like I was missing opportunity after opportunity. And I talked to people who, just like me, they only had 24 hours in their day, but they were more successful than me, and they also seemed calmer. They seemed like they were just on top of things more. They got more done. And I thought to myself, there must be some secret there that I'm missing. And when I started doing the research, I learned that that's exactly right. The most productive people and companies, they think differently. They are much more deliberate about making choices that the rest of us hardly even recognize exist as decisions in the first place. And so one of the things that I've done is I've completely reformed how, for instance, I set goals or how I write to-do lists. It's completely changed how I think about my day and the stories I tell myself when I'm on the subway on the way to work to sharpen my focus. When I need to be creative, I manage the creative process completely differently because I've learned that there are these companies and these individuals who understand how to manage their own thinking much better. And inevitably, that leads to them getting more done. They waste less time. And it's actually, I'll have to say it as a cynical reporter, it's actually transformed my life to be able to see.
Give me an example.
Well, so one of the great examples is my wife and I struggled for a long time to have dinner every night with our kids. Like, we knew that we should have dinner with them, and like, we always made it home late. And so when I was learning about agile methodologies in the Toyota production system, they introduced me to this idea called the five whys. And this is actually how Toyota makes lean factories, is if you have a problem, you identify the problem and you ask why five times and you get to a root cause. And so we said, okay, we keep on missing – we get home too late to have dinner with our kids. So let's use the five whys. So why are we getting home late? Well, it turns out that we always have like – we intend to leave the office at 5:30, but we've got all this stuff to do at the end of the day. So why do we have all this stuff to do at the end of the day? Well, usually it's because we're in meetings all day long. So why are we in meetings all day long? Well, it's because we inevitably get to work at like 9:30 right before the first meeting begins. So we never get a chance to like catch up on our email. So why are we getting to the office at 9:30 instead of earlier? Well, it's because we always want to leave the house at 8, but our kids aren't dressed. And so it takes forever to get them dressed. And then they're late for school and we're running late. And why aren't our kids dressed earlier in the morning? It's because they wake up and then they go and they watch TV. And then we have to harass them to go get dressed. So it turns out the reason we're not having dinner together as a family is because our kids aren't getting dressed early enough in the morning. So what's the solution to that? Well, we tell them that they have to lay out their clothes every night before they go to sleep and get dressed as soon as they wake up. If you had asked me how I solved the problem of us having family dinner, it never would have occurred to me that it has to do with how my kids get dressed in the morning. But once you begin to understand how to see the world as a series of systems, as things that you can analyze and break down, now we have dinner together on a regular basis.
Charles Duhigg, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're continuing our conversation about your economic worries. Is it something in your personal financial life or a bigger picture thing? Come tell us. Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.